From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help us keep this show on the air. Now, here's what's happening this week.
Part of our message in this initiative is no excuses. It will take courage, but you will have to tune out the naysayers who say the deck is stacked against you. You might as well just give up.
This past week, President Obama unveiled a major new initiative called My Brother's Keeper. It brings together leaders and communities to address the challenges facing our minority families and communities. And I'll be talking with Pastor Mike McBride of Lifelines to Healing, who was on hand at the White House for the unveiling of My Brother's Keeper.
And my job and my ministry and my academic work directly related to human rights issues, especially racial and religious profiling, discrimination, increasing homophobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia in American society.
Interfaith issues on college campuses are nothing new. Both conflict and cooperation flourish in institutions of higher learning. Doing important work in this field is Imam Abdullah Antepli of Duke University, and he will be with us later on this edition of State of Belief Radio. But first,
support for gay marriage has surged in the United States in the decade since it first became legal in Massachusetts, with just over half of Americans now supporting the idea, according to a survey released on Wednesday.
The Public Religion Research Institute has just released a much-anticipated major survey on American views toward homosexuality. While it's not news that those views have changed dramatically for the better over the past 10 years, there are multiple areas where PRRI identifies growing polarization as well as a misunderstanding of the view of others. The survey's titled A Shifting Landscape, A Decade of Change in American Attitudes About Same-Sex Marriage and LGBT Issues. And I am very happy to welcome back our good friend, the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, Dr. Robert P. Jones. Robbie, you've hit another home run.
Thanks, Welton. I'm really happy to be here to talk to you.
This was an overview of a decade of changing opinions. We all feel that there's been a big change, but the numbers really are enormous, more than one might anticipate. Would you start with some of the highlights of this survey?
What we wanted to do is take a look at a decade of change in American attitudes on same-sex marriage and other LGBT-related issues. So we picked this time period starting with 2003 when Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage and looking at change going forward. Overall, in the general public, we see a remarkable 21 percentage point change. So in 2003, only 32% of Americans supported allowing gay and lesbian couples to legally marry. That number, again, 21 points rise since then, is 53% today. And this rise in the general public has also really transformed the religious landscape on this issue as well.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the most change having taken place?
Well, one of the great things about this survey is it's a very large survey of 4,500 respondents, so it does allow us to look within different groups. There were no major religious groups supportive of same-sex marriage in 2003. Today, that landscape is very different. There are major religious groups supporting allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry. So, for example, in addition to three-quarters of religiously unaffiliated Americans, which, as you know, is one of the biggest growing groups, mm-hmm. Americans. So in addition to that group, though, 83% of Jewish Americans, 62% of white mainline Protestants, 58% of white Catholics, and 56% of Hispanic Catholics all currently support same-sex marriage. In Hispanic Protestants, which are kind of a more conservative constituency, tend to vote Republican, tend to be more evangelical, and even that constituency is basically divided on the issue. 46% favor, 49% oppose.
Mm-hmm.
There are really only two groups, two major religious groups, who oppose same-sex marriage, and that is African-American Protestants, among whom only 35% support same-sex marriage, and white evangelical Protestants, among whom only 27% support same-sex marriage.
Hmm. Are their numbers just about where they were 10 years ago?
No matter which group you look at, support has gone up. Just a little more than 10 percentage points among African-American Protestants and white evangelical Protestants. But, you know, support among Catholics, support among white mainland Protestants is 20 points or more. So, you know, even though there's different degrees of movement, the movement is all in the same direction. And even among more conservative groups like white evangelical Protestants and African-American Protestants who are conservative on this issue, there's still a double-digit movement towards support over the last 10 years.
Robbie, is the geographical distribution predictable, given what you've just said?
I would say yes and no. You know, on the one hand, Southerners and Midwesterners are still more conservative, more likely to oppose same-sex marriage than those in the Northeast and in the West. But what is remarkable, I think, is that in the South, for example, support was less than a quarter a decade ago and is evenly divided today. So I think that will be news to many of your listeners in the South, that in the South, the most culturally conservative area of the country, they're divided evenly. 48% favor allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry, 48% oppose. 10 years ago, it was down less than a quarter. So support has basically doubled over the last 10 years in the South.
Huh. Is it correct to say that age continues to be a major factor in determining where respondents stand on LGBT issues?
Absolutely. You know, two of the biggest things are age, and then the other thing is whether you know someone, have a close friend or family member who is gay or lesbian. But mm-hmm. but age is really hard to overstate the effect of age here. So, for example, just looking at you know, the issue of same-sex marriage here, when we look at generational breaks, 7 in 10 millennials, that is Americans who are ages 18 to 33, favor same-sex marriage. If we look at them compared to the oldest generation, there's a 32 percentage point gap. So only 37% of the silent generation, that is those ages 68 years of age or older, support same-sex marriage. So, and it's basically linear. So if you look at baby boomers, if you look at Generation X, every generation that gets older, there is lower support for same-sex marriage. But among the millennial generation, again, very, very strong support pretty much across the board.
You show in this polling a growing polarization within political and religious groups. Is that the right way to describe that part of the findings? And if not, correct me.
No, that's right. I mean, what we find is that in 2003, there was certainly a partisan divide on the issue. But interestingly enough, you know, we're showing that the partisan divide has gotten larger over time. So, for example, in 2003, only 18% of Republicans supported same-sex marriage versus 39% of Democrats. So that's a pretty big partisan divide, about a 21-point partisan divide. But today that divide is 30 points. So only 34% of Republicans overall support same-sex marriage, but 64% of Democrats support same-sex marriage. And independents are a little closer to Democrats. 57% of independents support same-sex marriage today.
Robbie, do you get any hint of what's happening in those political and religious groups? Is something particular causing that?
Well, I think the main driver, again, is age. So, you know, one example of this is if you look inside of some more conservative constituencies, those that are more likely to oppose same-sex marriage. So if you look at Republicans, for example, we were just talking about Republicans, there's a huge generation gap among Republicans. So if you look at the oldest Republicans, the silent generation, age 68 and above, only 18% of that generation supports same-sex marriage. But if you look at young Republicans, millennial Republicans, 50%, so fully half, support same-sex marriage. So one of the things you're seeing is among more conservative constituencies, a real generational strain on this issue. In the South, again, it's remarkable. So the oldest Southerners, only 28% of the silent generation in the South support same-sex marriage. 65% of millennial Southerners support same-sex marriage today.
PRRI has just released a major survey on American views toward homosexuality and how much those views have changed in the past 10 years. Robbie, you found a sharp disconnect between the percentage of people who support LGBT rights and the level of support they think there is among other people. Would you describe that discrepancy?
One of the more remarkable findings in the poll is the kind of misperception, I think, of where the country is on the issue of same-sex marriage. And I think this is partially a function of how quickly attitudes have changed. Virtually every poll that's been done in the last year across 2013 has found majority support. So we looked at, you know, six or seven different major polling outfits. Every single one, with the exception of Fox News, found majority support for same-sex marriage. And yet, when we asked Americans whether they thought that Americans overall supported same-sex marriage or not, we find a misperception. So only 34% of the country correctly said that most Americans support same-sex marriage today. So there's kind of a perception gap that's lagging behind the reality today. It also is remarkable that inside of churches, this perception gap is even more pronounced. So, for example, if we look at two groups that support same-sex marriage, Catholics and white mainland Protestants. We asked those groups whether they thought most people at their place of worship supported same-sex marriage or opposed it. Remarkably, among mainland Protestants, about 6 in 10 said that they thought their fellow congregants were mostly opposed to same-sex marriage. Now, that's almost the exact opposite of the reality. 57% of mainland Protestants who attend religious services regularly support same-sex marriage. We see the same sort of pattern among Catholics. 73% of Catholics think that most of their fellow congregants are opposed to same-sex marriage. And even when we look inside of Catholics who attend religious services more frequently, that is monthly or more, they're divided on the issue. So 50% in fact favor allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry. So there may be as much as a 20 percentage point perception gap here between people's sort of beliefs about where people are and the reality in the country today.
Do you have any idea where that's coming from?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, part of it just may be that they're not. And we know from other surveys that people are not hearing much about this issue in churches. So, despite the fact that many churches have taken public stances on the issue, when we ask people what they're hearing in their local congregations, they're mostly telling us not much. Mm-hmm. So I think that there just aren't conversations happening inside of churches, which leaves people, I think, with a perception of where things may have been 5 or 10 years ago as the reality today, when in fact attitudes have changed very, very rapidly, and they just haven't kept up.
You ask about marriage equality, you ask about adoption. What else and what did you see?
We also ask about employment discrimination, so job protections for gay and lesbian people in their workplace. There are also kind of a nice segue, because there's also a perception gap here. So when we ask people, for example, whether they thought employment protections were already a part of the law of the land, actually 3/4 of Americans incorrectly say that they think it's currently illegal under federal law to fire or refuse to hire someone because they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, when in fact that's not the law of the land. Mm-hmm. Now, when you couple that with the fact that nearly the same amount of people, 72% of Americans, favor laws protecting gay and lesbian people from job discrimination, that paints a pretty interesting picture. So, you know, one way of understanding these numbers is that, nearly 3/4 of Americans favor laws that would protect gay and lesbian people from job discrimination, and nearly the same amount think they're already the law of the land, even though it's not the case.
Hmm. What surprised you most about these results?
The one place that I keep coming back to are just how much age affects even constituencies that are pretty strongly opposed overall to same-sex marriage. 65% of Southerners who are millennials support same-sex marriage, compared to only 28% of the silent generation. Half of Republican millennials support same-sex marriage. When you couple that with the fact that millennials are one of the largest cohorts, they're very, very large. They're as big as the baby boomer generation, actually a little slightly bigger than the baby boomer generation. That spells, you know, big cultural change just on the horizon.
If you were to make a prediction for the state of these same issues 10 years from now, what would it be?
When we plotted out all the polls over the last 10 years, we looked at about 100 polls from seven major polling organizations, including our own, over the last decade. So when you plot all those on a chart, what you can basically do is take a ruler and draw a linear trend line, you know, through those numbers. It's very, very steady, very, very incremental, step by step, every year, sort of heading up, you know, a couple of points. So, you know, if we just go back to 2010, the number was 48. 2013, the number is 53, support for same-sex marriage. I don't see any indications that that trend will continue, you know, into the future. So, you know, I think as we move into from just minimal majority support at 52-53%, we head up into like 60% support, that's when you sort of see, you know, a real tipping point occur. We're already seeing it, you know, in the generation. So, you know, what I would expect is that this is going to be kind of a tidal wave that I can't see, you know, reversing, that we should just see continue in the next, you know, two or three years. I don't even think we need to predict it out to 20 years. Mm. You know, it's moving quickly enough that, you know, we'd see 10 years from now, there will be very, very few demographic groups in the country that oppose same-sex marriage.
Robbie, I want to ask one other question that I don't usually ask, but I'm doing the show today from Monroe, Louisiana, so I'm in the South. I am surrounded by large evangelical churches, and those are the people who are going to find these numbers hard to cope with. And the easiest reaction to that is to say, well, he must be a biased pollster, and I just don't believe those numbers. How do you respond when someone says that?
You know, one of the things we try really hard to do at Public Religion Research Institute is be very transparent. So, you know, we publish the full question wording, the full questionnaire up on the website, every question in the exact order it was asked, exactly the way it was read to respondents. You know, we're fully transparent about, you know, who funded the poll. The Ford Foundation funded this this survey. It's one of the largest surveys ever conducted. The margin of sampling error on this survey is only 1.7 percentage points. So, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room to talk about sampling error. We also try to, you know, get the best methodology we can. So we're doing 40% of our interviews, for example, on cell phone, which is the only way to reach younger people in the country today because many don't even have a landline. And I think the other thing to say is that other polls confirm it. So, you know, we're right in the ballpark. This is not an outlier finding. It's a more in-depth analysis of the findings that other polls have been providing. But, you know, the data points that we're talking about here are confirmed over and over again every time this issue is you know, done in public opinion research.
Thank you for what you do, and thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
As someone who's studied theology and religious studies myself, I mean, I'm hoping we are making some contribution to reading the signs of the times,
yep,
to put it in theological language that will be helpful as, you know, people reflect on the kind of current realities in the country.
With Black History Month having just come to a close, there is a notable new initiative coming out of the White House that will prove to be both historic and important to the African American community. This past week, President Obama unveiled this initiative called My Brother's Keeper, and on hand for that event at the White House was our friend Pastor Mike McBride of Lifelines to Healing, part of the PICO Network, and I'm very happy to welcome him back to State of Belief Radio. Mike, good to hear your voice.
Greg, it's great to hear your voice as well. Thank you for having me on.
Pastor Mike, tell us about the events of this past week. I know you were part of the White House meeting. Tell us what it was like.
Well, we are excited to be included in what we believe is a historic opportunity and moment for our country where the lives and the the issues, unique issues of black men and boys, brown men and boys, and our families are being able to have a unique space to be acknowledged and prayerfully considered a part of our national responsibility and focus. Today's event has really created a space for all of us to really have a wonderful conversation about what all young people need, and that is the opportunity to make healthy choices, the tools to be resilient and responsible, and certainly the chance to learn from their mistakes and make amends. So it is a very important moment for us to align all of the many programs that are already happening across the country, match them up with powerful policy remedies that can address structural barriers to the lives and the quality of life for our families, and prayerfully change a narrative, a very pervasive narrative that the lives of black and brown men are disposable, are trivial. We're excited to be able to be a part of a whole new conversation, and the White House is courageously leading that charge.
Do you know, I don't, whether there is any precedent for this kind of thing by a president?
I think that, you know, what is fascinating about your question is really, you know, the kind of emphasis and focus that all of us in the United States, all of us who have unique challenges in particular locations in our society, I think there's always a moment and an opportunity where, you know, the focus and a particular targeted approach is necessary. I think if you look at the history of our country, whether it is the Civil Rights Movement or the Women's Suffrage Movement, the movement around issues related to our LGBT community, et cetera, that every community that finds itself under undue distress mm-hmm. or certainly structural pressure and oppression or even, you know, kind of local contextual challenges, there is a role for all of our communities, our government, our clergy, our teachers, our family members, everyone to play. So I think it may be unique in the particularity of the focus for boys and men of color, but it is certainly not unique in the kind of focus and targeted attention that most of our constituents receive over time. Mm-hmm. And it is a very necessary moment given the very dire circumstances that are engulfing a lot of our young men and their families.
Mike, I this next question I don't mean as a negative question. I'm asking it to you because we are brothers in both interfaith work and in ministry. Mm-hmm. But do you have any – have you had the thought, I wish the religious community was doing this rather than the White House?
I believe the religious community is doing it. I believe that, you know, in many respects, the kind of charity work or the kind of social networks that we are attempting to, you know, create and solidify around boys and men of color have continued to be, I think, a very important part of this equation. I think the question has to be, can the faith community do it alone?
Right.
And I think that, you know, my response certainly just from my experience in the last 3 years of the Lifelines to Healing campaign, where we've been traveling from city to city, congregation to congregation, family to family, even person to person, there's a lot of goodwill, and there's a lot of folk who are really on the front lines attempting to address all the issues and all their complexities. Mm-hmm. What we need is a infusion of more support and also a very structural shift in the way that we treat boys and men of color in this country. Let us not forget that many of the social challenges of boys and men of color related to poverty, related to our over-policing and over-incarceration, related to the push-out that happened in the school setting, are not just because boys and men of color and our families are more criminal or have more behavioral challenges than others. It is that there are some structural challenges that tend to focus and exacerbate the common behaviors that happen everywhere. Now, certainly, when you look at the levels of violence, intra-violence that happen in our communities, The numbers are extremely high, and it is in these spaces where, again, I find more opportunity than apathy. We have been able to reduce gun violence in 4 cities in the last year by 30, 50, one city, 70%, just by our communities, faith leaders, working with law enforcement and the young men who are involved in these activities. So part of what I want to continue to say is the faith community is not only involved and at the front line, but we need more. We need more support. Dr. Robert Ross has a great article from the California Endowment. He says, we don't need more innovation. We need more scale, meaning we need to expand what we're doing, and the expansion can be more powerful if we have powerful collaborations with our federal, state, and local municipalities, as well as our foundation community, our schools, and certainly more clergy and faith congregations all across the country.
Talk very specifically for a moment about Lifelines to Healing and the PICO Network's involvement in My Brother's Keeper. What is your focus on? What are you looking at right off to do first?
Well, I think one of the first and most important contributions we've tried to make is continue to push a narrative that shifts, a narrative that honors the dignity and the humanity of our boys and men of color. We are sons and brothers. We are husbands and fathers. We are more than the worst things that we may have done in our lives. As the faith community, we believe we have a moral imperative to insist that our country resist the lazy urge to assume that boys and men of color all fall into these very narrow, reduced categories. So we call it proclamation. We have a prophetic proclamation that we want to express. And we want to make sure that is infused in these initiatives that are coming out of the White House and the foundation community and certainly the faith community. What does it mean for us to remind everyone that we are all created in the image of God and that we all belong to the family of God? And even in our worst moments, we should not abdicate our responsibility to care and to love for one another and create opportunities for restoration, healing, and service to our God and our families. And then I think we then continue to do the more important, the other important work of advocacy, of making sure that there's a policy framework that is nuanced, that is robust, that is well-resourced, that has a very targeted approach. Let us not forget that there already are certain policies that are targeted towards African-American and Latino men, whether they are immigrants or whether they are citizens. The over-incarceration and over-policing of our communities are a result of targeted policies. The ways in which our communities continue to find economic barriers are a result of targeted policies. So we want to say, rather than targeting our over-policing, our over-criminality, why don't we target opportunity and target pathways and ladders out of our worst conditions? And then we will continue to do on the ground the daily programmatic work that continues to address issues of violence through guns, whether it's a ceasefire strategy. We will do mentoring work. We will continue to do our reentry work, making sure that we're registering folks to participate in their civic duties, whether it's voting, whether it is getting on committees and councils, organizing. We will continue to do all of that powerful work. And it is in this way that I think a very powerfully aligned and coordinated strategy through our lifelines, we can create communities and opportunities where our young people and families can live free from the fear of gun violence, live free from the fear of trauma, live free from the fear of incarceration, and indeed become our brother's keepers.
Mike, would you say just one word about how other houses of worship and communities of faith can help you?
A great question. You can visit our website, www.lifelinestohealing.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, Lifelines2Heal. And on our website, you will find a number of strategies that are happening very, very shortly here in the future. On March the 14th, 15th, and 16th, we will be doing another national gun violence Sabbath weekend, where we will be continuing to preach, to pray, and to act. Congregations can get involved by lifting up many of these concerns in our congregations, inviting those to come into our spaces as we pray for them, and then engaging in action of compassion, of advocacy and intervention, and help focus and refine our congregation's understanding about the way that violence and trauma and incarceration impact our community. And then you can also become what we're calling live free congregation. Again, live free congregation. And on our website, you'll find in the week to come wonderful opportunities for you to join this effort to champion these issues, to be a consciousness raiser around these issues, to bring even your own congregational influence and institutional power into the very local, state, and national efforts to make sure that boys and men of color can indeed live free and have a wonderful opportunity to experience their best possible life. So visit our website, and you'll find many, many options, and we look forward to partnering with whoever and wherever you are.
Pastor Mike McBride leads Lifelines to Healing, which is part of the PICO network. This past week, he was at the president's unveiling of a bold new plan called My Brother's Keeper. It's always good to have you on State of Belief Radio, and I really appreciate you doing this one.
Well, God bless you, Reverend. Thank you for always having us. And together, we're going to continue to make a very profound difference. And thank God for your life and your ministry.
Abdullah Antepli is the Muslim chaplain at Duke University, one of only a handful of full-time Muslim chaplains at U.S. colleges and universities. In his coursework in Islam, as well as intra and interfaith work, gives him ample opportunity to observe modern-day campus faith relations. And so I'm very happy to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. Imam Abdullah, welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I know interreligious work is growing in many areas. How do you see it expressing itself on the Duke campus?
Duke is, I think, several steps ahead in the conversation in terms of fostering, facilitating rich and meaningful interfaith conversations on college campuses because it has so many wonderful opportunities to do so. We have every possible religion, faith, ideology throughout the world is represented on Duke campus in our Gothic wonderland. And the administrators, the religious life team, it's really part of the general curriculum to make sure this diversity that we enjoy, we will get, we will take advantage of it, and we will take get the best out of it by fostering meaningful cross-cultural, cross-religious, and cross-faith conversations in an intentional and deliberate way.
Are there areas of particular conflict that you see within the academic community related to all of this pluralism?
Well, I think one of the most common tension is to keep the confessional side of religion and the believing, practicing people's personal devotional aspect of religion out of the academic conversation and study religion as a neutral subject, like you study physics, chemistry, etc. I'm glad that tension is very low on Duke campus. We have all these voices represented, but I think for the most part, Duke University welcomes that confessional, believing, practicing aspect of faith traditions of all. We have a divinity school here. We have a beautiful chapel, which is the soul of our campus, at the heart of our campus. Religion is important, and nobody is categorically denying or rejecting its voice in any kind of conversation. In social justice, in political issues, in social issues, in ethical and moral issues.
On Duke's campus, where do you see common ground as most fertile? In other words, how do you foster dialogue around all of the issues that we deal with in interfaith relations?
How to do it is easy, and it's been done pretty much anywhere and everywhere. But how to do it really meaningfully and beautifully and in a sustained way, to do it for a long, multi-year plan is the most difficult one. Regretfully, I mean, it's better than nothing, but most interfaith conversations on college campuses end up becoming just a singing kumbaya sessions where people of different faith come together and say good things about each other and they exchange information in the basic level of their faith tradition or on a particular theme, what their faith tradition says about X issue or Y issue. I think those conversations happen all the time. What we need to take this to the next level, other than information sharing, how can we explore and invest the common issues within our faith traditions, invest in those commonalities, and build coalitions and alliances responding to our unique common challenges?
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of really encouraging activities that we do here. For example, there is a very sustained, well-organized, meaningful interfaith conversations and actions that the different members of the faith communities on the campus, like the Catholic Blue Devils and the Muslim Blue Devils and the others, we come together and build Habitat for Humanity houses. We serve in soup kitchens. On the backyard of the Center for Muslim Life on the campus, we will be building an interfaith community garden. Many religions will be involved. On our Center for Muslim Life site, we will be developing an organic vegetable garden, and we will be serving the outcome, these organic vegetables, in a local soup kitchen together.
Oh, that's great.
And we have built an educational component to this when we bring Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Protestants, Hindus, and Buddhists to do planting, do weeding things out, and picking up vegetables. There will always be a brief moment of sharing a scripture or a prayer or an explanation. And then we will do this at any aspect of this interfaith garden project.
I want to ask you, because I think you are in a place that would handle this in the most responsible way possible. When the news is filled with Islamic and I'll say, I know it's an unequal, but Islamic and Western tensions, and I could just say Christian tensions, how does that spill over into the academic discussions and the religious discussions? And do you find a way through some of the tension that comes from politics that could affect religion?
Well, you are asking a $1 million question and pointing out a huge pain and a tons of weight that every Muslim living in the West, especially in the United States, has to carry by just being Muslim.
Right.
Because of this post 9/11 image of Islam, and because of the way in which Islam as a religion and Muslims as people are covered in the media and all these political events in different parts of the world, and our involvement as a United States government, our involvement in different parts of the Muslim majority societies, it brings an interesting challenge to us, both as Muslim and non-Muslims, that it definitely spills over to the academia. You are often put in a position to explain what Islam is not,
right,
who Muslims aren't, before even you say anything about what it is and what is this all about. That's a heartbreaking and discouraging challenge, and it's in so many ways in different parts of the country it's getting worse.
Yes,
there are pockets of American society, including some campuses, some religious communities, some churches in particular, because of the kind of sources of information that they have about Islam and Muslims, they constantly keep feeding themselves with these very biased information, and inevitably over the last 11, 12 years they have built this very unimpressive image of Islam and Muslims.
Yep.
Some other parts of the country, it's been a big learning curve. Islam has never been discussed, explained, taught in the last 11 years, previous century.
Yeah.
I am hoping that the common sense, wisdom, grace, and compassion will prevail, but this is definitely one of the major social homeworks of American society, to understand and appreciate Islam and Muslims and include this new faith community to the social fabric of American society.
I really think, Abdullah, that you're so right. And I am sad to say that there are some people who don't want to understand Islam. They are more comfortable with the conflict than they are complementary relations, and that makes our work even harder.
Yes.
You have an impressive history over 10 years. You were at Wesleyan, then you were at Hartford, now you're at Duke. How has your work changed over the last 10 years?
In many ways, I'm filled with gratitude. This is one of the, I think, my ministry over the 10, 11 years, things in a very modest way, what I was able to do, reflects the very many beautiful things about the American society.
Mm-hmm.
In its fundamental DNA, this society cherishes pluralism, diversity, inclusivity. This country is built upon those ideals where you will be judged based on what you do, not based on who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the relative small, modest success in my own personal life as an immigrant cat from Turkey came to this country 11 years ago and now involved in various levels of this conversation shows that this country at its heart is still very, very healthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But these challenges will not go away anytime soon. And it's not unique to Islam and Muslims necessarily. This society have gone through similar challenges with homophobia, with anti-Semitism, with racism, with sexism. And the relative success that we have achieved in all those areas, the job is far from being done. But if you compare American society, if you compare us with the rest of the world, I think we are in a much better situation. I am hoping Islamophobia, this recent challenge, the same challenge showing itself in a different way in the form of Islamophobia,
mm-hmm.
I'm hopeful. But there are times I feel, of course, discouraged. Do I want to just pull my hair and scream?
Right.
Because after all these years, people are still asking those very fundamental questions and associating Islam as a religion and Muslims as people always so quickly with all sorts of negative, destructive, pejorative, un-American realities.
Well, I respect the way that you have handle that and still been so good in your leadership. I'm out of time, but I've got to ask you one other thing.
Sure.
The news just came out this past week that the nation's oldest seminary, Andover Newton Theological School, has hired the school's first Muslim faculty member, Celine Ayat Lizio. Do you see this as a significant historical step, or is it more a matter of something that's been far too long in coming?
It's an overdue progress, but it is very, very significant. You can never underestimate and undermine what this symbolically means for Muslims and non-Muslims. These Protestant Christian seminaries and theological schools having Muslims on board and seeing this social homework that I just mentioned
mm-hmm.
as an important aspect of training future Christian leaders. You can no longer train any clergy in any faith tradition uniquely and exclusively in that faith tradition. We have to equip our future religious leaders with interfaith muscles, interfaith skills and tools as well. And Andover Newton is basically being one of the pioneers.
Yeah. Well, Imam Abdullah Antepli is the Muslim Imam at Duke University. Having worked in this capacity at several institutions of higher learning, he brings an insight that's particularly informative. And I have to say, it really is hopeful. Imam, you and I have got to talk again because we've got a lot of resonance. And I think even that we understand each other enough that I can ask you, do Muslim chaplains and Christian chaplains have to pray against North Carolina when you're at Duke?
Absolutely. I think the college basketball is a prime example how you can build an overarching identity. And these religious differences, borders, it will mean nothing. If you see Blue Devil Catholics, Jews, and Muslims, the way they love Duke and hate UNC, that gives you some hope.
You're exactly right. And listen, thank you for doing this today, and I really do hope that we'll do this again soon on State of Belief Radio.
I hope so, and blessings.
Now, before we go, a few words. If it seems Like only last week that I spoke to you about an outrageous pro-bigotry bill masquerading as religious protection legislation. That's because it was. Last week, we noted with relief the death of a Kansas bill that would have enshrined a dizzying range of expressions of bias under the auspices of religious freedom, of all things. This week, we were waiting to see what Republican Arizona Governor Jan Brewer would do with a similar bill that was waiting for her signature. Well, Governor Brewer, who hasn't shied from controversy during her tenure as governor, did veto the bill, and I strongly applaud that action. But with more such state-level initiatives in the pipeline, not because there's a flood of attacks on religious liberty across America, but because some well-funded national conservative legal firms have decided this is the current ground zero in the culture wars, this is something we're going to have to keep an eagle eye on going forward. They're not done yet. The damage this stuff can do to LGBT persons subject to legally sanctioned discrimination, to persons led into a misguided sense of victimhood by those who would exploit that sense of victimhood to divide and defeat us, and to the very concept of religious freedom itself, which is a very real and very urgent issue in many parts of the world, the potential damage of these kinds of legislative initiatives is significant. Because this is happening at the state level, it's harder to keep track of, and it's harder to challenge. So far, the worst ideas have failed to make it into law. But I'm afraid it's really just a matter of time, unless each of us takes responsibility for engaging the issue in our own communities, recognizing that it is in our hands to let our legislators know that we are watching them. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We can only produce this show with your generous support. People like you keep us on the air. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to this work today. We'll use it wisely, I promise that. We'll try to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the outreach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics that we have discussed on this week's show, and you'll find resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week. On Facebook and Twitter, there's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 202-681-4246. As always, we encourage you to tell other people about the show and join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.